Is the state social studies standards revision process more accessible or more political? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, August 11th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Dakota political junkies Tom Dempster and Jonathan Ellis join me for analysis of a working group, an education department, and a political kerfuffle. Then SDPB Seth Tupper is with us for a look back at the renaming of Black Elk Peak 5 years later. We'll hear from the man who made the vision a reality. Plus, a call for the professional development of women in Sioux Falls. Then we head west to the Black Hills National Forest with photographer Paul Horsted as part of our SDPB Spotlight. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson. Teachers, educators, and other South Dakota citizens charged with crafting new state social studies standards say Governor Kristi Noem's administration deleted many elements intended to bolster students' understanding of Native American history and culture from their draft. Members of the working group said Tuesday that they were caught by surprise when the department released the new document last week. They say changes made to the draft they submitted in late July gave it a political edge they tried to avoid instead of aligning with the Republican governor's rhetoric on what she calls patriotic education. The Department of Education has not responded to a request for comment. A little under 60% of South Dakotans have received at least the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Medical officials explain the impact vaccines can have for children. Dr. Michael Wildy is Chief Medical Officer for Sanford Health. He says vaccinating children over 12 can protect other students.
There's kids in school with bone marrow transplant, type 1 diabetes, illnesses like that, that can make them pretty vulnerable to this. And so be a thoughtful member of the community. Set that example for the kids.
Wildy says even though children have a smaller chance of being hospitalized from COVID-19, there is still a possibility of severe symptoms. Dr. Michael Elliott is Chief Medical Officer for Avera Health. He says preliminary data shows 10 to 20% of people who contract the virus will have long-term health effects.
But if 10 to 20% of those little ones are going to end up having long-term headaches or long-term fatigue or long-term respiratory problems as a result of it, does that change the conversation at all or change the way we think about whether we should be getting them vaccinated?
Elliott says the coronavirus will continue to mutate if too few people get vaccinated. Both of South Dakota's Republican U.S. senators opposed the $1 trillion infrastructure bill. The Senate passed the legislation, which now goes to the House. Senator Mike Rounds participated in months-long negotiations on the bipartisan legislation. However, he says the final bill includes progressive mandates and federal funding clawbacks that he can't support. Rounds' team has not responded to the requests for further clarification on those provisions. Rounds missed the vote on the bill. He was with his wife, who was undergoing cancer treatment. John Thune voted against the bill. He says the bill should be fully paid for, which he says is not the case in the legislation. The package is financed through a combination of methods like repurposing unspent COVID-19 relief funds and tax enforcement for cryptocurrencies. The Congressional Budget Office predicts the bill would add about $256 billion to deficits over 10 years. The executive director of the Rapid City Regional Airport says the jet fuel shortage seen in areas of the western U.S. is not having an impact on visitors traveling to the annual Sturgis motorcycle rally. Airport executive director Patrick Dame says that although air traffic is up in Rapid City, the western South Dakota airport has not heard as many complaints regarding jet fuel as has been expressed in other airports further west. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem issued an executive order on July 17th to address concerns about looming fuel shortages in the western part of the state. To access our stories, visit the news page on our website at sdpb.org/news. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The 81st annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally is underway. Well, yesterday we talked about the workers churning the economy as thousands of bikers converge on the event. Today we're talking collisions, citations, and arrests. South Dakota Highway Patrol Captain Jason Ketterling is with us for that. Captain Ketterling, welcome to The Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Could you talk for just a moment about the law enforcement and policing preparations ahead of the rally? What does this operation for public safety really look like?
Well, you know, it really begins shortly thereafter, the preceding year as well. So it's a continuous process. We've been fortunate. You know, we've had it out here for several years in a row now, and we work together out here. As a group, both state, federal, county, and city law enforcement agencies coming together, and it really is a team effort. We're fortunate to have those relationships built and gel so good together, but it takes a lot of planning, effort, and staffing, as you can about imagine.
Yeah, let's start with collisions or accidents. That's one of the things we always sort of look for, especially hoping for no fatalities or fatal accidents. What can you tell us about collisions this year as compared to previous years?
Well, you know, last year was a little bit of an anomaly, I would say, as far as what the pandemic and everything that brought into it and its impact on the crowd that we had. You know, we've seen our crash numbers remain about where they were at this point last year. We have had one reported fatality so far this week, and we've seen an increase in crashes overall. We had even leading up to the rally as well. I think one of the unique things we saw yesterday was the increase of crashes that we had in the Southern Hills area. I mean, if you've been out here at all, it's very obvious we've got a good crowd out here this year.
Yeah. All right. How about DUI arrests?
DUI arrests are running about the same they were last year, you know, and very typical of the rally. You know, we always are pushing the don't drink and drive campaign. That's no different during this rally as well. And unfortunately, we are making some arrests with some impaired drivers out there on the roads.
Yeah. What are we seeing for drug arrests? And particularly, I'm wondering if we're seeing any kind of impact or confusion from what's been happening in the state about approving marijuana. How are we handling, you know, drug arrests? What sort of drugs are you picking up this year?
Well, it's a mix, and it typically always is. You know, there have been some changes with the marijuana laws recently and continue to a little bit. But, you know, really yesterday was a little bit of a busier drug arrest day than we've had before. With some drug arrests, but for the most part, they're also, again, remaining about the same, just down slightly, though.
Yeah. All right. To clarify for listeners, recreational marijuana is not currently legal in the state of South Dakota. Is that something that you're focusing on? How do you, when people talk about enforcement on marijuana charges, possession charges, do you have an overall policy?
Yeah, we do. We have a framework that we're enforcing, the laws and regulations on it, and it seems to be working well. So,
all right, Captain Ketterling, anything else that you wanted to add on some of the policing efforts in Sturgis this year?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we're going to see, due to some events going on in Wyoming today, we will see an influx of traffic traveling from Sturgis over into Wyoming. So, any travelers that are out in this area, just be aware of that. And for anybody traveling West River, you know, just continue to leave some space between the motorcycles and you. Or if you're out here riding, just be aware of the terrain and topography that you're driving in. And really just having some time and patience to get through the area. We have continued to reduce the interstate speed between Rapid City and Sturgis at 65 miles an hour. And it's busy out here, and would just ask that people allow themselves some time to get your destination and pay attention to what's going on around you.
Yeah, that sounds like common sense. And if you've been out there during the rally, it's difficult to put into practice, but take that deep breath and do the right thing. You'll be glad that you did. Captain Kettering, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
A man whose voice was heard in Washington with thoughts on the 5-year anniversary of the renaming of Black Elk Peak. That's coming up next. Seth Tupper has a story. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I opened my closet of really tired, old-looking clothes, and I think with this like blast of courage and insanity, I'm not gonna wear any of these. I'm just gonna wear my snow boots and my trench coat.
Stories about midnight adventures. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Listen Saturday afternoon at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, encouraging the development of artistic talent and appreciation in all South Dakotans. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artssouthdakota.org.
Hard work breeds confidence.
I've never felt like, oh, am I good enough? There's always too much pressure on me to overperform in every single way.
Next time on How I Built This, Lindsay Peoples-Wagner of The Cut on imposter syndrome.
And how hyperinflation in Venezuela led to clan warfare via a video game. That's coming up on The Next Planet Money.
And How I Built This from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 2 Central, 1 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
You can support local music by supporting the network that gives local musicians voice and opportunity. From A Moment in Sound to Jazz Nightly, we're on air and online at sdpb.org.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. When Basil Braveheart conceived the idea for renaming Black Elk Peak, he went looking for a reporter at the Rapid City Journal in Rapid City to share the idea with the public. Well, the man he found was Seth Tupper, and Seth wrote the first news story about the proposal. Tupper continued covering the story for 2 years until the peak was renamed. Well, Tupper is now a supervising senior producer for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and he recently caught up with 89-year-old Braveheart to reflect on the transition. Seth Tupper is joining us today from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Seth, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
So this is, this happens to reporters all the time and nothing comes of it. Or people wander in and say, I have a story. And you're hanging out working in 2014 and he walks into the newspaper office and you happen to be there. Tell me, set the stage a little bit for me.
Yeah, it was just a normal day. It was September 2014, and I just happened to be the newsroom at the Rapid City Journal's on the second floor. I happened to be the reporter who was standing nearest the stairwell. And somebody came up from the front desk and said, there's a guy here who wants to talk to a reporter. And to be honest, I kind of sighed and rolled my eyes a little bit because sometimes you get a great news tip when somebody walks in off the street, and sometimes you just waste, half an hour of your day.
Right.
But I went down there and met Basil Braveheart and sat down with him, and he said that he wanted to change the name of Harney Peak and shared his idea that he thought it should be named Black Elk Peak in honor of Nicholas Black Elk, who was a Lakota holy man and kind of a renowned spiritual guide who's passed on many years ago, but he wanted to rename the peak. And it sounded intriguing, and I asked him, well, what have you done about it so far? At that point, he had written letters to the congressional delegation. I asked him, have you contacted the South Dakota Board on Geographic Names? Because I was familiar enough with the board from journalism to know that, they were in the process of changing some offensive place names and things like that. He said he hadn't, but he would. And so I said, well, I'll write a story on this. We'll see where it goes.
And, all right, let's go back and define who Harney is. When we talk about the reason why he thought Harney of the Harney Massacre was a good thing to consider renaming.
So William S. Harney was a career military man in the 1800s, and he was known in the parlance of those days as an Indian fighter, and he led a number of campaigns out here on the Great Plains. And one of them that he led in 1855 resulted in what was later called the Harney Massacre, where he led an attack on an encampment of Native Americans that resulted in killing not only male combatants, but also some women and children. And that is what really got Basil Braveheart thinking about the fact that he really didn't think Harney's name should be on the highest peak in the Black Hills because of some of the atrocities that were committed in that campaign. And that's what really, some research into that was one of the things that really got him thinking about wanting to do a name change.
Yeah, let's hear from Basil Braveheart. What do you want to hear first? This sort of the beginning seeds of this, yeah?
Yeah, so he not only was doing research into Harney, but around that time he says he had a dream where his grandmother came to him in this dream and was teaching him some of the lessons she taught him as a child about forgiveness and actions that need to be taken to grant forgiveness. And that kind of combined in his mind to produce this sense that this name change really needed to be done. Here's what he said about it.
I'm using the word sacred vibration because in Lakota, the word vibration goes to our original reference to the divine, which is Taku wa kansh, kansh kan, meaning something is in sacred motion.
Sacred vibration. Okay, well, this starts out as sort of an improbable proposal because this is a federal decision. Walk us through some of the early stages of what the state board on geographic names kind of decided.
Yeah, one of the reasons this was such a memorable story for me, to be completely honest, I didn't give this much of a chance of succeeding, you know, knowing what I know about South Dakota and things. But Braveheart did send a letter to the State Board on Geographic Names. They agreed to consider it. They held a series of public hearings around the state. And as a result of that, some of the board members were really moved by some of the testimony. And they initially voted to change the name of Harney Peak to Hinhan Kaga, which I'm probably mispronouncing, but was that was an alternative proposal that came up during the hearings that a lot of people said was the traditional Lakota name for the peak. Mm-hmm. Well, after they took that vote, they got a lot of backlash, a lot of political pressure from people who didn't think the peak's name should be changed. They took another vote and decided to recommend no action, and they sent that recommendation on to the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. And a lot of observers just assumed that the U.S. board would also take no action because they don't often oppose or take a different action than the state board. But what people didn't know, and what I didn't really know at the time that Braveheart told me recently, was in that interim period, somebody from the national board, he says, reached out to him and asked him to make a video explaining why he wanted the name change.
A simple video for most of us, not so much for Basil Braveheart.
Right, and yeah. we have a clip here if you guys want to play it about the story of how that went down.
So I said, okay, I wonder how I'm going to do this. He said, well, do you have a smartphone? I said, no. Does your son have one? I said, I don't know. Well, if you got to find someone, call someone and see if they can come to your house and make a video of you and say what they want you to say. And just about that time, knock on a door, and this woman that was supposed to come and meet with me about some other issues that we're dealing with, she was at the door, and the first thing I said is, do you have a smartphone? She said, yes. I said, come on in. I said, can you take a video of me of what we're doing here? We want to have a video and sent to Washington. And she said, well, do you have the number and the link and all that needs to be sent? So when this guy that called me, I said, how do you do this? He said, okay, I'm going to give you the link. I didn't understand what that meant, but he sent it and gave it to this woman. And so she recorded me, and it wasn't very long. And then she said, I'm going to send it right away. And she got the numbers and clicked on some numbers, and it went within an hour, they received that video in Washington.
Oh, ye of little inspiration, because it all is just lining up. And what happened next? I mean, this is, he beats the odds, you know, how?
Well, you know, on August 11th, 2016, the U.S. board votes to change the name, which surprised a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I asked Braveheart, you know, you're just this guy who has an idea, living in a very rural area, no smartphone. How did this happen? And he says it was, you know, a lot of help and prayer from others, but just a really deep belief. And here's what he said about that.
In my Lakota tradition, when dreams like this come to you, I had the deepest knowing and awareness that this was going to happen.
Hmm. He knew it all the time. Everyone else doubted, but he did not.
That's what he says, yes.
Yeah.
He was one guy with an idea and belief and courage to act. And,
just a matter of time.
It happened.
All right. So what has he been up to since the name change?
Well, a lot. Nicholas Black Elk, the late Nicholas Black Elk, has been nominated for sainthood recently by the Catholic Church because Black Elk was a practicing Catholic later in his life. As part of that, Braveheart says that he's been contacted by people in the Catholic Church who wonder if the peak renaming might have been a miracle, which is something that's required evidence of a miracle for sainthood. So he's taken those calls. He's also taken calls from people who want advice about changing the names of geographic features. Mm-hmm. And he always tells those people, he mentions his dream, and he asks them if they had a dream as well.
And so I said, if anybody had a dream, that is an email. Or that's a call from the divine, say, I'm with you.
Hmm. All right. He's also thinking about this context that we're living through today with other renamings and, you know, monuments and statues and rethinking them. Did you talk to him at all about that?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I called him, because obviously we've been through this continuing thing in the country with Confederate statues and everything else. Yeah. and sort of the debate over that. He says he hears a lot, you know, today in those arguments similar to what he heard back then in opposition arguments to the renaming of Harney Peak, and namely that we should let history be history and just move forward. And here's his reaction to that.
That is, when I hear some of this stuff today, that the fear of bringing the history, the truth, was something that I was hearing loud and clear. So we were touching, We were kind of hitting something there that needed to be done.
Seth, what does this story, the work that he, you know, this name change really, what does it really mean to Basil Braveheart?
Well, I asked him that, and he was very reflective about it. He said he's actually hiked to the peak once since the renaming, which in his 80s, he said it took him 9 hours. Couldn't believe he did it, but he did. And he does go to the base sometimes to visit the base of the mountain as well. And this is what he said about how he feels now when he goes there.
Something happened that's unexplainable. But when I go up there, I feel more being part of the mountain. When we go up there and we sing these songs at the foot, I feel the sacred vibration of the mountain.
An incredible story. You can go back and listen to this conversation after the show. We'll post it on sdpb.org/news with a link in today's show notes. Seth Tupper, thank you so much for being here with us, and thanks for not running up the stairs those years ago.
And, it was a lucky day.
And listening to, was it a lucky day or was it a miracle? We'll find out. Thanks, Seth.
You're welcome.
Ahead on the program, the Dakota Political Junkies discuss social studies standards and why it's become such a hot topic in South Dakota. You're listening to In the Moment, South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll travel back to 1985 and hear bassist Harvey S., guitarist Mike Stern, and drummer Alan Dawson perform at a Cambridge jazz club. Also on the program, the sounds of drummer Ulysses Owens Jr. and his big band, and the married duo of vocalist Gene Baylor and drummer Marcus Baylor. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Mitco Business. We're in the business of helping partners go up and to the right. Head in the right direction with customized business internet, phone, and TV solutions to stay in touch and in control. More at midco.com/business.
Yes, so Lord, let me be happy. Be happy. Oh, Lord, let me be happy. Yes.
Let us all be happy. I'm Larry Gross. Join us each week for Mountain Stage Live Performance Radio from NPR.
Listen Saturday evening at 6, 5 Mountain, and Sundays at noon, 11 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Sanford Underground Research Facility, advancing South Dakota's economy, creating jobs that support world-leading science, education, and our communities. More about America's Underground Research Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Department of Education is in the midst of a scheduled update of statewide social studies standards. Well, that process is gathering headlines across the state, largely because the Department of Ed made several revisions to the draft proposal that had been crafted by a working group. We'll start right here for today's Dakota Political Junkies. My guest, Tom Dempster, is a former South Dakota State Senator joining me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. Tom, welcome.
It's good to be here, Lori. Nice to see you.
And on the phone, Jonathan Ellis, investigative reporter for Argus Leader Media. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, Lori. Tom.
Hey, Jonathan.
Jonathan is just so good at laying out the facts for people, so sometimes we just rely on him to tell the story before we get started.
Nothing is better.
Jonathan, explain this process and why we're talking now about something that most people would see as kind of a mundane governmental, educational, pedagogy sort of thing.
You mean like every 7 years when we redo social studies curriculum?
Yeah.
That mundane?
Like, yeah, who knew that that was going to be what we were talking about?
Right. Well, I mean, before we jump right into that, Lori, let's remember that education is often very political. I think this year we are celebrating the 20th anniversary of something called No Child Left Behind.
Mm-hmm.
We saw Common Core was a hot button issue. So anyhow, not unusual that this is political. However, you know, it is a little unusual that this particular process is getting as much review as it has in the last, but certainly the last couple of days, because, you know, the standards were released and there was a concerted effort by this working group to include, you know, more references and more background, more history of Native Americans in South Dakota, which obviously, you know, are our largest minority group in the state and a significant part of the state's history. And that was part of the draft that was released at the end of July. And since then, some of that has been removed by the Department of Education. The process by which that happened is still a little murky, but this whole process now takes shape and goes ahead and goes to some public forums. I believe there are four public forums throughout the state to discuss what's in these standards, and then eventually the State Board of Education will decide whether or not to adopt them. So there will be a very public process moving forward, something that actually didn't used to exist, and I think probably Senator Dempster might recall that. But so then, you know, you have public hearings now on these, and people will have an opportunity to weigh in. Obviously, some of the members of the working group are upset that as much of the Native American history has been kind of removed. I think there were some thoughts among some members that, you know, that some of that maybe wasn't as age appropriate as it should have been in some parts. So, you know, there's some give and take on that committee, which is, you know, roughly, I think, about, you know, several dozen academics for the most part.
Yeah. So we should be specific. It's a lot of what I say removed is officially Ochechi Shakuin Oyate education. When we say Native American Indigenous people, we probably should narrow it down to specifically some of the standards we're, you know, understanding our relationship with the Ochechi Shakuin Oyate. Tom Dempster, let's talk about the preface. because the working group turned in a preface, which is now mostly the August 5th revision is largely, most of their content was moved to the introduction, and there's a new preface. I went back to the 2015 standards. At that point in the preface or introduction, there was no mention of the founders per se. It was largely education speak. What the working group did is put in a sentence or two about the founders of America. That sentence was kept in the introduction, and then we have this new preface, which is really focused on the founders, the U.S. Constitution, rights given to you by your creator. Is that, in your mind, a political addition, or is it more like a preface of accessibility like you would see in a textbook that's like we're getting away from the education speak? When you look at the preface and some of that language, because the accusation has been, oh, it's been politicized, do you see that preface as clarity, accessibility, or politicization? It's a very nuanced question.
No, it isn't. I mean, it's a great question, and to the to the best of my ability, I'm happy to answer the question. First of all, I mean, this is a process. Mm-hmm. It's not a conclusion. The results aren't in because the results will be in until the process is completed, and the process is mostly a process of public hearing after public hearing after public hearing after public hearing, and that is as it should be. Mm-hmm. But the preface. Classical conservatives have long thought that fundamental truths of America, those fundamental truths are we are born equal, the natural rights of man, life, liberty, the pursuit of property, Christian virtues such as love, the golden rule, are all very fundamental parts of who we believe ourselves to be in, who we believe ourselves to be in America. And those fundamental truths, all truths endorsed by the founder, by our founders, endorsed by the Constitution, particularly endorsed by the Bill of Rights, many conservatives will say, we really need to center on these conversations again so we understand who we are and who we have the potential to become. So when I see that in this preface, I go, I can endorse that. That makes sense to me. That is not political. That's who we are, or that's who we attest to be, or Lori, that's whom we try to be.
Yeah. Ellis, any thoughts on the preface? Shared values and expansion? It read to me more like a textbook introduction than a political manifesto. I know I'm venturing into opinion there, but I felt like I was reading, the beginning of a textbook that was trying to invite other people to sort of think about this process. Like, what were some of your first thoughts when you looked at how the preface had been refigured?
Well,
I love that deep breath he does, Tom. Yeah. That's a classic Ellis.
Yeah, hey, Jonathan, I'm with you.
I don't want to venture in the opinion there. I mean, a textbook is probably and if that's how it sounded to you, that's probably appropriate. I mean, I guess I would say, and this kind of dovetails a little bit with Tom and what classical conservatives and how they believe. I mean, I will say that I think it's inarguable that we as a society have graduated generations of people who don't have an adequate understanding of this nation's history, all parts of it, by the way. And I mean, it was the foundation for, I think, when Jay Leno did his skits, they would go around and ask people just the most basic things about American history, and people wouldn't know those things. Mm. And so I think it's just very clear that we need to do a better job of teaching these subjects. And certainly I think, obviously in South Dakota, particularly indigenous Americans, are a big part of that history. So we just need to do a better job all around. And that goes back to, I think, teaching the founding principles of this country, which, again, in light of where the world was in 1776, were quite revolutionary.
Tom, I want to pick up on something that Jonathan kind of was passing to you earlier in this conversation, which was this notion of input from the Board of Education and from lawmakers and, you know, No Child Left Behind and core curriculums. Not the first time that education by any means has become, you know, a little bit of a political football. Can you provide any insight to what he was kind of trying to fish out a few minutes ago from your experience in the state legislature? What is the appropriate sort of back and forth between the State Department of Education and lawmakers, the governor, and then this kind of working group of educators, museum specialists, and professors, academics?
Well, just about any time you talk to to a Native American, and I'll get there, Lori, by the way. Anytime you talk to a Native American about controversial subjects, as Kent Norburn talks about the deep black hole that we have in the state of South Dakota with respect to Indian education and so on and so forth, I always ask them, well, what is the solution? And their response is always conversation. Let's talk about it. Let's get together and let's talk about it. And that's why I say I'm not troubled I've been on 1,000 advisory boards where we don't have decision-making capacity, where our responsibility is merely, quote-unquote, merely to give advice. This was, 48 members, maybe 50 members on this task force. It is not a decision-making capacity. This is all about building a viable and a strong conversation, which is the way that we process things and the way that we decide things in the state of South Dakota, not to mention in this democracy that we have. I think it's part and parcel of the process, part and parcel of the solutions.
And so I'd just like to say to listeners, this conversation takes time.
Indeed.
And this is only the beginning of it.
So
we will continue unpacking everything from the Ohtete Shakopee essential understandings to this process. Secretary Tiffany Sanderson will be on the program at some point in the future. There's public input is open now for, you know, kind of email and letters to come into the State Department of Education. I'm going through these things page by page, Jonathan, and it's just, I don't know, it's such a great lesson in what we were thinking in 2015, what this working group was thinking, what the Department of Education is thinking. I'm kind of enjoying the process. I don't know about you, Jonathan Ellis, but it's interesting stuff. Of course, I don't have 4 kids that I'm sending to elementary school that are impacted by it. So once again, it's always interesting if it's not, if you're not going through it in an intense way. Any final thoughts, Jonathan?
No, I'm going to look forward to seeing how this plays out. And, this just education in general has been such a hot button issue. Certainly you saw that with the Rapid City school board election. There are a lot of people who are taking interest in these issues that normally don't. So it will be interesting to play out.
Yeah. Shout out to the teachers, Tom Dempster, who are in the middle of all of this. And let's put a plea out for that conversation to be respectful and thoughtful and to involve a lot of listening. Yeah.
Those wonderful people who have the capacity of being patient and have the capacity to inspire our children. How could you pray? How could you ask for anything better than that?
Tom Dempster and Jonathan Ellis. You can find Jonathan Ellis's work at argusleader.com and in the print edition of the Argus Leader newspaper, which comes out daily. Jonathan, thank you.
Hey, thanks. Always fun, Lori.
Yeah. Tom Dempster, former state senator. Thanks for stopping by and talking to us in person. We appreciate that.
Nice to see you as well.
Nice to see you. Let's take a moment now to honor inductees into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. The enshrinement ceremony for the class of 2020 is on September 10th and 11th. Delta David Geyer is the maestro for the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. He's led the orchestra since 2004. During that time, the orchestra has transformed both in performance and community impact. We visited with Delta David Geyer on In the Moment, September 8th of 2020.
Went to school, conservatory, thinking I was going to be a trumpet player, and then I picked up a stick in class one day, and the heavens opened and said, you will now do this. I mean, I actually went to school on scholarship for 3 different areas, the trumpet and piano and voice. And all of my teachers would say, you know what, if you just focus on one thing, you'd be really great, but you've got too many irons in the fire. And I just found it impossible. And then I picked up the stick and they were like, oh yeah, of course. Well, you're a conductor. That's what you are. That it was became evident that I had this facility for communicating among a large group of people, a vision behind the music and being able to bring people together. It's much more than just waving your hands. I had a facility for that, but it was this interpersonal kind of relationship that just was, it just fit like a glove. I had to give a nod to my father here, the biochem professor, because my father was a great teacher, a great communicator. And it wasn't like he taught me any of this. It was just kind of through osmosis. In my field, there's no room for anything but excellence. Like, you just don't make it. And the value of art is not recognized as it, you know, the foundations of it going back hundreds and thousands of years. But for some reason, entertainment has pushed it all out. And so to be able to bring the value of artistic expression to the fore and to have people understand why it's important, that's just simply a joy for me.
More In the Moment is ahead on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. Director Sean Hader immersed herself in the world of children of deaf adults, or CODAs, for her new film, and she learned how kids connect their parents to the hearing world.
You're the conduit between these two points, and your job is to sort of deliver information and receive information, but in a way you don't know who you are.
Next time, Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
South Dakota Home Garden offers more opportunities for you to learn during South Dakota's short but sweet growing season. SDPB makes it easier by sharing gardening advice across all our platforms. Join us on TV, radio, and online at sdpb.org/sdhomegarden to keep your gardening ideas fresh this season.
Staying informed is more vital than ever. With NPR by your side, it is easy to keep up with the latest news. We're at your fingertips on your phone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Listen at sdpb.org or download our app.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Though the impact of the pandemic on women in South Dakota remains largely unmeasured compared to other states, many of the national trends of women leaving the workforce to make significant changes in their careers seem also to be showing up in South Dakota. Well, several programs are already in place across the state to provide professional development and mentorship for women. Today, we're going to explore one program, the Women's Leadership Program at MB in Sioux Falls. And since we're on the radio, EMBE. MB. Janet Hasing is MB's Chief Development Officer, and she's with me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Always an honor.
This is one of those really vibrant programs. There's a new cohort, but you're not starting this program out for the first time. There's already a pretty solid network in this area of MB Women Leadership cohort graduates.
That is right. There's quite a family of graduates of this program and others who've participated, bringing the content to these women, mentoring the women along their path. So all told, between the 250 graduates of the program and the 100 volunteers who've in some way been a part in the last 10 years, it's quite a group of people. You come, you yourself, and you leave as a part of this group who've had this transformative experience together.
New cohort coming up representing
all manner of of jobs. You know, there's nurses who participated in the program, always folks from our business community, our nonprofit community, our entrepreneurship community are all represented. There's quite a wide variety of positions showing out in this year's class.
Now, it seems like I can safely predict that the experience of the pandemic is going to come into play in some of these conversations because everybody seems to be rethinking. We see it in the job shifts, people going from one place to the other. It's a pretty good time to be reconsidering why you're doing what you are doing and how you can do it more authentically.
Absolutely. And that, I think, is one thing that has been really unique about this program through the years is that our participants tell us it's an opportunity to take this time and really reflect on personal and professional development goals, to think about values and what motivates you and how you show up and how we authentically are ourselves in the work that we do in the ways that resonates through other parts of our lives, in our homes, in our communities, in the way we come together. It's just one of the strengths of this program, and certainly these times that we've shared the last however many months now, I have to think will be on the minds of these women as they're making these reflections and thinking about who they are today and who they want to become.
Yeah, some of the themes that, and I especially want you to think about people who are listening across the state and are working on their own sort of professional and personal development programs, maybe in a smaller community. What are some of those takeaway lessons for how you structure the program? What do women need? What are the areas that are just really valuable to focus on?
Well, women are just about half of the population of our state, right? And the vast majority of our workforce across the United States. Though we've seen declines, women are still 57% of the workforce. So there's quite a lot to consider when you think about what women bring. Ultimately, the theme is much like all of other MB programming, the idea that women are stronger when we gather together. And when you think about the history of our organization over the course of the past 100 years, it just really plays out. When women come together to solve problems, good things happen. When women come together to invent and reinvent themselves or systems, there's really positive benefit to the community. So those themes of gathering, of reflecting, of pulling together community resources, who in your community can help you learn and who can help you grow. There's all manner of people leading from all different walks of life, so lots of opportunities to engage in conversation. And the one real differentiator, I think, for this program, Lori, is after the sort of classroom learning component that many members of leadership cohorts will be familiar with, this program matches each woman participating with a mentor based on their personal and professional goals. So there's an opportunity to grow sort of as a group, but then to grow together in a smaller setting with someone who may have walked this path before, whose insights can help you. And that's something all of us can find in our lives. Look for those people who are our role models and our leaders and think about ways we can cultivate those relationships.
Yeah. What is your message to people who are thinking about being a mentor but think, no, I have not yet arrived? Because women have a tendency, at least in the past, to when they're invited, and I remember this from writing print articles all the time, I would call somebody, and if I was interviewing a male executive, they would always say yes. If I asked to interview a female executive, there was a period of time where the first time they would always say, no, I don't think I'm worthy of this story. And then I would call a second time and say, here's what we're, and you'd have to kind of, you'd have to invite them more than once. So people who are afraid to step into that leadership role, that mentorship role, what's your message to them?
Well, you're leading from where you are, whether you realize it or not. You know, think about where you've been in a time where you wished for what you have now. Many of us are fortunate and privileged, and so there we share these opportunities, not always as experts, but as someone else who's working and striving and growing and learning. And the moment any of us feel we've truly arrived, we're probably really in trouble, right? We have something to offer one another, and there's just great value in being asked.
Yeah. What are some of the components, before I let you go, of just, you know, salary negotiations, value clarifications? What are some of the key sort of steps to the MB Women Leadership Program?
Yep, there's this idea of values identification, the idea of building personal brand, notions around building one's own personal development plan, really identifying what's important to you, set that vision, and then taking the steps to get there.
Yeah, what's important to you?
What's important to me, doing a bit of values exercise yesterday, I really value connection. So family, community, with others who share and align with my values is really important. I value my time. I value the way I grow relationships with people, and I need a little adventure and learning in there too.
Nice. Well, it has been a wonderful adventure to have you here in the studio. Jen Hasing is MB's Chief Development Officer, and we'll put some links up to the Women's Leadership Program on our website after the show. sdpb.org/news. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you so much.
As In the Moment spotlights the Black Hills National Forest all August, today we're going to look at the forest through the eyes of a professional photographer who has noticed many changes over the past decades and also things that have stayed the same for more than a century. Paul Horsted traces the path of the Black Hills exploration through historic photographs, including the first photos ever taken of the region. He's published several photography books and speaks on the topic frequently. One of his books is called The Black Hills, Yesterday and Today. And Paul joins us on the phone now. Hey, Paul, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Laurie. It's great to be with you again. Thanks.
So much of what I know about the forest before we even started this project, I have learned from you. So first of all, art, we can talk about the science and the technology of photography, but the, you know, reaching people through the art of the Black Hills is a really powerful way to get people pulled into the conversation. Talk a little bit about that and how you sort of see photography as an invitation.
Sure. You know, about 20 years ago, we first published our book, Exploring with Custer, the 1874 Black Hills Expedition. As you said, you know, these were the first pictures taken in the Black Hills. And through a whole chain of circumstance, I find myself standing at these photo sites with the photo in hand and trying to replicate that image, that exact angle, you know, even down to the rocks and the stumps in the foreground, and taking a modern picture to see what's changed, what stayed the same. Can we learn about, you know, history? And there's a whole bunch of levels that you can take away from those photo pairs, I think. And I just got totally hooked on that, and I began looking at other photographers who had worked in the Black Hills in the early days as well. But these primary early first pictures taken by William Henry Illingworth in 1874, who was along on this expedition, are really still something I'm very focused on today. In fact, I just went back to all the sites last summer again to kind of take a second look and see what had changed in the last 20 years. So there's a lot of directions you can go from there looking at them.
Yeah, the Illingworth photos were at the South Dakota State Historical Society. Tell me, like, the first time that you knew that photo collection existed and sort of how they were, you know, kept.
Yeah. Just a brief history on that. You know, he shot the pictures, of course, in 1874 and had a career in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he was, that's where he came from and went back to after the expedition, continued shooting images there and died in 1893. And then a collector in that era even recognized, I think, what these were and acquired his whole collection and eventually sold them to the State Historical Society of South Dakota in 1921. They had to get a special appropriation from the legislature because they didn't have $60 to buy the collection of about 75 negatives at that time. So they've been in the State Museum since then, and not every picture he took in the Black Hills survived in its form, but we also have prints that he made. They're called stereo views, these things you put into a viewer and you'd see a three-dimensional image when you looked in there, and that was a technique that a lot of photographers used back then. So we have either a good print that he made or the original negatives, which have now been scanned and look just amazing because they're these 4x8-inch original glass plate negatives. You scan that in, you have all this detail, and you can zoom in and see details of the campsites and of trees and rocks and landscapes. Mm. So it's awesome to be able to look at them that way.
So centuries of history of this place exist before someone comes with a camera and starts documenting it with this
right.
current technology. But since that time, you have spent, I don't know, thousands of hours, you know, really considering, you're not just passing through. It takes a long time to make one of these photographs and to contemplate where it's at. How have you noticed the forest changing?
Yeah, the really short answer that we noticed right away back in 2001 was that there are generally speaking, and not in every instance, and I'm hesitant to draw snap conclusions from just two pictures, but you know, generally you see more trees, and in some cases the trees even block the view where the original photographer had this open view of a valley or whatever. So that's kind of the short answer. Due to fire suppression, like my understanding from talking to experts and forestry people, is that generally it's because we've been really good at putting out lightning-caused fires since settlement in the prior years before settlement. If a fire started somehow, you know, lightning strike or whatever, it would just burn until it ran out of fuel or until winter came. And so that would thin the forest naturally. And this is something that's going on all over the country, of course, not just in the Black Hills. But so you see this general increase in forest, growth and bushes and so on. But now in the last 20 years, we've had this pine bark beetle epidemic, you know, and that's pretty much witness to it. They're living near Custer. It was surprising to me to go back again last summer. I went to every single site. There's about 50 of these photo sites through the Black Hills. Some of them look basically the same as they did in 2001. Some of them had a few more trees, and then there were a few where the pine bark beetle, who I'm starting to consider a friend, had cleared out the trees that had grown up in the last 75 to 100 years, and now we had these kind of open vistas again. So that was really interesting to see that transformation.
Yeah. A photographer friend.
Lifetime.
A friend of the photographer.
Yeah, there you go. He might have saved us from a big forest fire, too. I mean, you know, there's still studies going on, I think. The amount of trees that disappeared in that epidemic of the it's the mountain pine beetle actually
right.
You know, really did thin the forest, and I think maybe in a helpful way in many cases.
Yeah, so much more to talk about. We're having this conversation all month, and of course it will not end in August because covering the forest is a big part of what we do. You can find Paul Horsted's work on his website at paulhorsted.com. Horsted is H-O-R-S-T-E-D. And
thanks much.
One of the books we've been talking about has been The Black Hills Yesterday and Today, and it's just where I've gotten just a ton of information for this month's coverage. And Paul, thanks for always coming back and being a friend of the show. We appreciate your time.
Well, it's been a joy, Laurie. Thanks again. I hope to talk to you again soon.